This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 119 was recorded on May 24th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. This week, the 10-year Treasury note slipped back down below 3.05%, the red line so many analysts had drawn in the sand as the supposed point of no return, which they said, if closed above, would mark the irrefutable evidence that the 35-year bond bull market was over and a new secular bear market has begun. They further predicted yields would only increase from there. This week proved that prediction wrong, at least the last part of it, as the 10-year yield fell back below 3% on Wednesday afternoon. One voice who's been remarkably consistent and remarkably right when it comes to Treasury yields has been that of Dr. Lazy Hunt from Hoisington Asset Management, who will join me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll explore whether any of the bond bull is dead rhetoric has changed Dr. Hunt's fundamental views on fixed income markets and discuss Dr. Hunt's macro outlook for the global economy. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when the Macro Tourist blog author Kevin Muir will be joining us to discuss his own perspectives on fixed income and much more. We'll also have an important announcement about the first Macro Voices live event after the market wrap just before the interview with Dr. Lacey Hunt.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 looked like it was correcting earlier, and suddenly on those Fed minutes, we saw a big jump in the S&P undoing almost all the selling. What's your takeaway here on the S&P 500?
Well, Patrick, we've been in a trading sideways in a consolidation pattern between about 2,700 and 2,740 for the last week and a half. And I think, you know, we had a pretty strong rally. We had that breakout above 3.05 on the 10-year Treasury. That seemed to put things into pause mode, and we started trading sideways. Now, interestingly, even after we slipped back down below 3% this week, the rally didn't resume. So it kind of reinforces the view we've been talking about, which is, yeah, I think a summer rally is on, but I don't think we're headed towards new all-time highs. I would be surprised if we actually got to new all-time highs. I think more likely the top is in, and it's just a question of how this topping process is going to play out for the equity market.
Okay, let's move on to the dollar index here. What's your thinking on the dollar?
Well, Patrick, the chart still looks plenty bullish to me. We've seen a little bit of a pause here, but frankly, with the 10-year yield pulling back as much as it has, and a lot of people thought that increasing yields were part of the strength in the dollar, you know, we didn't see a reversal of direction. We've just seen a slight pause in the move upward on the dollar index. So I think the chart still looks really strong, and I'm very curious to see what happens from here. Of course, everyone knows that I have a huge and immense respect for Juliet de Klerk, who has told us to expect a reversal to the downside. So we'll see what happens. But as I read the chart, it still looks to me like there's a pretty healthy rally in place here.
All right, Eric, let's move on to crude oil. What's going on with oil this week?
Patrick, it's been a curious week in crude oil prices, to be sure. Analysts were expecting a 2 million barrel drawdown on crude oil inventories. That would be a modestly bullish signal if it had been confirmed by the inventory report. Instead, we got a 5.8 million barrel build on inventories, massively bearish signal. Cushing, Oklahoma drawing down 1.1 million barrels, but gasoline building 1.9 million barrels, distillates drawing down 951,000 barrels. So across the board, we end up with a net-net of builds on inventory, which is a very bearish signal. Of course, the market just tanks to the downside, going immediately down and testing its 13-day moving average. But you know what, Patrick? Within about an hour and a half, it had fully retraced. By the end of the day, it had moved to a higher price above where the inventory number came out on Wednesday morning. So it seemed like the market was going to shrug off this inventory inventory report on Wednesday and keep moving higher. Then as we got through the day, actually beginning on Wednesday night and all through the day on Thursday, we moved much lower in price. Not apparently in reaction to Wednesday's inventory number, but perhaps it was Donald Trump changing his mind about the summit with North Korea that has changed things. And of course, North Korea doesn't really have anything to do directly with oil production, but it's a good proxy for the state of the United States' degree of geopolitical engagement. So what seemed like they were about to be peace talks that might lead to some kind of peace agreement between the United States and Korea have been put on hold. We'll have to see what happens there in terms of the geopolitical outlook.
All right, Eric, let's move on to gold. Has anything changed from last week's perspective on gold?
Well, Patrick, we have been consolidating. You know, we broke down below that 1305, 1308 support level. I was surprised we didn't go much further. Maybe that was a sign that the market had more strength for a rebound than I expected. I think the very lowest print that we got down to was just over 1280. And now on Thursday afternoon, we broke back above 1305. Now, most likely the upside today was owed to President Trump changing his mind about the summit with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. So we'll see what happens, whether or not this can be sustained. But so far, it looks like maybe gold wants to recover to the upside. We'll have to see how the geopolitical situation pans out in coming days.
And finally, what's your take on the 10-year Treasury yields? Where are we heading from here?
Well, Patrick, as the old saying goes, financial markets are designed to make fools out of the maximum number of people possible. And of course, so many people were staking their reputation on this idea that if we saw a break past 3.05 on the 10-year Treasury, baby, that was it. It was all downhill from there in terms of price, uphill in yield. It was all going to be over. And of course, Wednesday afternoon of this week, we slipped back below 3%. As we're speaking just before the close today on Thursday, we're looking at 2.98 on the 10-year yield. So it's a big question to me. Does this mean that we actually had a false breakout, which would be a very bearish signal in yields, bullish signal in price? Is that short squeeze that we thought was possible in 10-year Treasury futures actually upon us after all? Let's wait for the postgame segment when I want to bring that topic up with Kevin Muir from the Macro Tourist.
And before we go on to our feature interview here, we have a special announcement to make. What's going on here, Eric?
Well, this came up as a result of emails that we received right after the show that we did with John Malden. I was kind of bucking for a spot at the Strategic Investment Conference, something I'd love to speak at. And we got a couple emails saying, hey, quit sucking up to John Malden. Do your own conference. Do a Macro Voices Investment Conference. And, do it that way. And that actually, we appreciate the suggestions that we get from all of our listeners. I happened by happenstance to be talking to Jeff Snyder. Jeff and I are both going to be in Toronto in August on our own respective summer holidays. We first talked about getting together for just a beer at some point to catch up on old times. And it was Patrick's suggestion to say, hey, remember those listener suggestions we had for a Macro Voices conference? We're going to have Patrick, myself, Kevin Muir, who you're going to, of course, hear later on in today's show in our postgame segment, as well as Jeff Snyder, are all going to be in Toronto in August. That's almost a full financial conference by itself. If we were to get one or two other of our featured interview guests into the program, we'd have a pretty interesting financial conference. So what we've done is we put a survey together. If anybody is interested in attending our first ever Macro Voices live event, it would be a one-day financial conference with Patrick, myself, Kevin Muir, possibly, Jeff Snyder, possibly, as well as maybe some other Macro Voices feature interview personalities, each giving a presentation on a topic of interest. It would be in Toronto. Tentative date that we're looking at is Friday, the 10th of August, although that certainly could change. We haven't even talked to the hotels and other conference venues to see what's available yet. And what we'd like to find out from our listeners is this kind of event of interest? And if so, what's your preference? Would you rather that we keep it minimal, keep the cost as low as possible? We're not going to try to make any money on this, but we've got to charge you something in order to recover the cost of the conference facility and so forth. Do you want a minimal cost event, which might be Patrick, myself, Kevin Muir, maybe Jeff Snyder if he's in town? Or should we spend a little bit more money, increase the cost of the ticket, and look at maybe flying in one or two really popular feature interview guests? So we've got a survey together together, which you can find a link to in this week's Research Roundup email. If you're in Toronto or thinking about a holiday in Toronto in August, please fill it out. Let us know what you're thinking, and we will make an announcement in upcoming shows as to whether or not we're definitely going to do this and what the particulars will be.
Well, thanks, Eric. And so this week we have Dr. Lacey Hunt from Hoisington Investment Management as our featured interview guest. Eric's interview with Dr. Lacey Hunt is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Many investors claim to have been around way back in the day when Alan Greenspan was Fed chairman. Today's guest, Dr. Lacey Hunt, defended his PhD thesis 50, that is 50 years ago in 1968, back when William Mackenzie Martin headed the Federal Reserve. He served as HSBC's chief economist and has held many other very senior roles in the industry. Today, he is with Hoisington Asset Management, and he has been spectacularly consistent and spectacularly right about treasuries for many years, with so many other experts in the field declaring that the bond bull market is over and that a new secular bear market in bonds is on the table. Dr. Hunt, we wanted to get you back for your view. Do you agree with the people who are saying, okay, that's it, it's over? And if not, what is the bullish argument for the bond market?
I do not agree, and I have to admit it's a lonely position. My view is that we're going to see lower long-term treasury bond yields in the years ahead. I think the best and most complete and consistent theory of interest rates was provided to us by the late Nobel laureate Milton Friedman. And the main conclusions of Friedman's theory is that monetary deceleration, such as we're having today, ultimately lead to lower interest rates, so not higher interest rates. What Friedman had in mind is that when the Fed engages in a tightening of monetary policy, what he called a liquidity effect, this tends to raise the short-term rates, but it begins to restrict the flow of money and credit. If this liquidity effect is repeated several times, it will eventually produce a countervailing income effect in which the rate of increase in interest will be slowed as the economy begins to moderate its rate of expansion. And if the monetary deceleration extends for a protracted period of time, ultimately the inflation rate will fall, and hence Friedman's conclusion, monetary decelerations ultimately lead to lower interest rates, not to higher interest rates.
Okay, so if the secular trend is still toward lower interest rates, how do you at Hoisington think about a situation like we have today where so many people disagree with you? Does that just create a variant perception and a better opportunity to enter new long positions? Or how do you look at this situation where so many people have an opposing view?
Well, we focus on a multi-year trend. We do not believe that short-term developments in the credit markets are predictable. But we believe over time, the economic fundamentals can be assessed in terms of their major trends. And there are a couple of things that we're focused on, aside from the fact that a major monetary deceleration is underway. And that is the United States economy, all the other major economies of the world, and now the emerging economies of the world are pursuing a path of extreme over-indebtedness. And our research believes that this path actually triggers the law of diminishing returns through the production function. And so while massive increases in debt can lead to a transitory boost in economic activity, this effect is relatively short-lived, and ultimately the higher debt undermines economic growth, and so over the longer term, extreme indebtedness leads to weaker economic activity, which of course is consistent with lower inflation and lower long-term bond yields.
Now, if the argument for lower long-term bond yields is basically that there's way too much debt, over-indebtedness around the world, it seems to me, you know, an opportunist might think, wow, if you understand this picture, as you clearly do, because you've been remarkably consistent and remarkably correct about this for many years, it would seem like an opportunist would be inclined to go pursue something like shorting the high yield debt and so forth. But at Hoisington, you focus only on duration management in the treasury market. Why is it that you focus on that and you apparently have chosen not to pursue what seems to me would be an opportunity for someone with your perspective and knowledge, which is to look at something like shorting junk credit?
Well, first of all, we are investment managers. We're institutional, fixed income only. We only operate in the U.S. Treasury space, and we take no credit risk. We have a relatively small staff, and our objective is to pick up these major multi-year trends. And over the last long period of time, we've been able to rather consistently outperform the Barclays aggregate, even though we've given up the higher coupon that one would have obtained if they had invested in the spread product. So we're strictly duration managers. If we think that the multi-year trend in interest rates is upward, then we'll go to the short end of the curve. But we don't short the curve. We just go into the shorter maturities. And if we think the longer-term trend in its inflation is downward, then we hold a very long duration, as we are now.
And you are now at your maximum duration, so it seems like there could be an argument to kind of cut back on duration risk and see whether or not the other people that are pushing the market create an opportunity. Do you just not trade that way, or do you believe fundamentally that now is a time to be maximum duration exposure?
Well, we're not at maximum duration. Our duration is in excess of 20 years. We could, if we wanted to, and we thought the circumstances warranted, we could buy all zero coupons with a 30-year duration. But we're not that bullish on the outlook. But we are very bullish, and we think that's the long-term trend.
Okay. And what are the factors that lead you to that? Right now, you say you're just over 20 years in your average duration. What is it that leads you to believe that's the place to be on the curve right now?
Well, let's talk about it both on the production side of the economy and on the demand side of the economy. On the production side, the production function is determined by the three factors of production, which would be capital, labor, natural resources, and the level of technology. The demographic factors right now in the United States and the rest of the world are very weak. In the United States, we have a bust in the population growth rate. We have a baby bust. The fertility per 1,000 women fell to a new all-time low in 2017. That was just released. We have a family formation bust. And the demographics are even weaker in Europe than they are in the United States. And in Japan, population's not even growing. It's actually declining. The U.S. economy is getting older. Europe is even older. Japan is older still. And even in China, although the demographics are much better than in the U.S., Japan, and Europe, they're deteriorating there. And so the possibility that we get a boost on the production side from labor is limited. Natural resources as a factor input have been relatively stable. We've made certain new discoveries, but we've also used up existing resources, natural resources, and haven't been a factor for a long while. And the way most governments in the world have tried to boost output is through taking on more debt. And so we pushed it through capital. One of the derivatives of the production function is the law of diminishing returns. If you begin to increase labor output initially, or labor input, you'll boost output. If you continue to boost labor input, the rate of gain will slow, then it will turn flat, eventually will turn negative. Same is true in the current situation, but the active variable is debt. Now, some may say that technology will bail us out. And we certainly do have interesting things happening, but the very distinguished economist Robert A. Gordon from Northwestern University produced a book that was published last year called The Rise and Fall of American Economic Growth. And Dr. Gordon's point is that inventions that we're having today are more evolutionary than revolutionary, and that they do not entail the massive use of labor and natural resources in the past. Dr. Gordon looked at what inventions occurred in the great period of American economic growth from 1870 to 1970, and the things that did it were electricity, modern communications, the internal combustion engine, urban sanitation, and pharmaceuticals and chemicals. And we have things that are going on, but they're just more marginal. And so in that type of environment, the increasing use of debt capital is going to trigger the law of diminishing returns, and the economies will get weaker. In addition to that, we have a situation where the extreme indebtedness has pushed monetary policy into a situation where it's basically asymmetric, and fiscal policy is not even operative at all. But let me explain. When the economy becomes extremely overleveraged, such as we are, small increases in interest rates cause a big increase in interest expense. In addition, the indebtedness has an undermining effect on the velocity of money. Velocity is a very complex concept. It's just as complex as the consumption function or the investment function. But over the longer term, for the money turnover to pick up, you need to be able to generate an income stream that repays all of the principal and interest. And our debt is increasingly not of that quality. And so with high debt levels, not only does small increase in interest rates produce high levels of interest expense, but the velocity of money falls. The velocity of money in the first quarter of this year is where it was in 1949. And it's been in an irregular decline, very massive irregular decline since 1997. And so the Federal Reserve is engaging in a program of monetary restraint, and that's working to slow the economy at a time when we have all of these structural problems that I just identified that are affecting adversely the production function. Now, the possibility, and many people buy this notion, is that the tax cut is going to provide the economy a boost. However, this is a debt-financed tax cut. We didn't cut other forms of spending in order to. We're borrowing the money. And there can be a small boost to the economy when you increase federal spending and cut federal taxes, both of which have occurred very substantially in the past 6 months, if the debt is sold to the Federal Reserve and are the commercial banks. But the Fed is actually selling government securities, and so are the banks, which means that all the rest of us, in other words, the households, the corporations, what we call the non-bank sector, is essentially funding the tax and expenditure changes that are coming back to the household and business sectors. In other words, there's no net creation of funds. And so the net result is that the large increase in federal debt as a result of the tax increase and a huge increase in federal spending that took place in March, a so-called bipartisan deal, we've added close to $2.5 to $3 trillion of federal debt over the next 10 years. Before the end of the next decade, gross government debt will reach 120%. It was just under 106% at the end of last year. So what we have is we're taking policy actions that are popular politically, but they are not going to produce economic activity. And the Federal Reserve, because of an uptick in certain price inelastic goods, such as energy and health and property and casualty insurance, is tightening monetary policy, and this net mix is not helpful to the U.S. economy remaining in a vigorous mode.
Now, where the whole theme here is the source of the problem is over-indebtedness, too much debt. A lot of people would argue that if that's the problem, that it's going to result in low treasury yields for a while. But some people would argue eventually you've got to reach the point where it becomes impossible to repay that debt in real terms. Of course, it can always be paid back in nominal terms if you print enough money. But in real terms, a lot of people would argue it becomes impossible to ever repay the debt. Do you agree with that argument? And if so, how far away are we from that point?
Okay, well, let me first of all say that under the Federal Reserve Act of 1937, the Fed does not have the ability to print that money, does not have the tools nor the mechanisms to print money. This has been said repeatedly. It was said during quantitative easing 1, 2, and 3. The Fed can expand its balance sheet, but it does not control the money multiplier, or little m as it's called. So you would have to rewrite the Federal Reserve Act. You could do that and then give the Federal Reserve authority, but that requires a basic change in legislation. Once you were to do that, you could then stoke inflation. Unfortunately, what we've learned is that these theories of grand design, such as having the Fed, giving the Fed the legal capacity to print money, produce changes that are not really totally anticipatable. A lot of unintended consequences occur. But what we know from history is that when central banks and governments proceed along this path, they only raise inflation, they don't raise real growth. And so one of the consequences of giving the Fed the ability to print money is that it would further undermine the well-being of 70 or 80% of our households, which are already doing poorly and have not been served well by the high debt policies that we've been pursuing. In other words, we do have some in our society that because of their abilities or capabilities or their income and wealth base, they can progress whether we have slow growth or no growth with inflation or without inflation. But the vast majority of our people do not perform well at the extremes. And this is true whether the growth is slow with low inflation or whether the growth is slow or non-existent with high inflation, that you leave most of our folks behind. And so we could change the Federal Reserve Act of 37. But at the end of the day, what we would have is we would make the United States the equivalent of Venezuela or Argentina or the Weimar Republic. But at the current time, the Federal Reserve does not have the ability to print money. Now, I forgot the major thrust of your question, but I didn't want that money printing issue to go, and that's why, so if you could just repeat that question for me.
Well, thank you, because that actually strengthens the question. Thank you for pointing that out. So realizing now that the Fed, under its current charter, cannot just print money in order to make the debt go away, does this problem of over-indebtedness, does it eventually reach a point where it becomes impossible to ever pay that debt back? Certainly when individuals borrow too much money, eventually they get to a point of no return where all of the income they could possibly ever generate won't even pay the interest payments, and they can't get out of that debt burden. Is there a risk of the U.S. government getting there?
Mm-hmm, a very fair question. In other words, does trying to solve an indebtedness problem by taking on more debt eventually get to the point where it changes the end game? And I don't think it does change the end game, because if the law of diminishing returns is applicable, and we just undertook an expansion in federal debt over the next 10 years of at least $2.5 trillion, maybe more. So let's say we go into a downturn, and some sharp analyst says, well, look, we just had a major increase in federal spending and a major reduction in taxes, and that didn't really help us. So we tried $2.5 billion. Why don't go $5 billion or $10 billion? Well, you see, we're in a nonlinear world. The law of diminishing returns is nonlinear. And so we double the rate of increase in debt, and we get faster and more negative results. And let me give you some historical evidence on this. We can look at three periods of extreme over-indebtedness, in which are fairly well documented. That would be the United States, and all of these periods have in common that the extreme over-indebtedness produced a panic year, and that after the panic, the economy went into a period of prolonged economic weakness with falling inflation. The first of those episodes occurred in 1873. The U.S. had taken on a great deal of debt to build the transcontinental railroads. If you'll remember, we built the Central Route first, and then Northern and Southern routes, and all kinds of feeder lines, a number of industries that fed them expanded greatly. State and local governments guaranteed some of the debt. There was overinvestment, overconsumption. The panic year was 1873. President Grant was in charge, had no idea what happened to him. And the United States was in a low deflationary environment all the way into the 1890s. The second case, was, of course, is better known, but similar result. We took on a great deal of debt starting in the 19-teens all the way to 1929, 1930. Causes originally were pretty reasonable, but we got into overinvestment, overconsumption, overspeculation. Panic year was 1929. And then the third case, more recent, is Japan in 1989. Panic year was brought on by extreme overindebtedness. Public and private debt in Japan at the time was approaching roughly 300% of GDP, which is where China is today. Slightly higher than where we are today. And now the Japanese public and private debt is in the vicinity of 600% of GDP. And so one of the things you can do is you can start from each of the panic years and you can track the progression of the longest maturity treasury bond or government bond and compare that to how we're tracking since our recent panic year of 2008. And if you do that little exercise, what you'll see is that after 10 years passed since our panic in 2008, the current level of the long U.S. government bond is very close to where the JGB was 10 years after 1989, where we were 10 years after the panic year in 1873, and 10 years after the panic year in 1929. So the indebtedness undermines economic growth and brings down the inflation rate and produces low long-term interest rates. And, you know, there have been some pretty important studies of a more recent nature. There's probably a dozen or more econometric studies that have looked at the impact of high debt levels on economic growth. And what those studies show is that when government debt goes above 90% of GDP and holds there for 5 years or more, that you lose about a third of your growth rate versus trend. Well, we're well above that now. Our government debt, gross government debt, is about approaching 107.5% of GDP. So we've been well above that 90% threshold and for more than 5 years. So we should have lost about a third of our growth from trend. Well, historically, in real per capita terms, since 1790, the economy has grown about 2.1% per annum. But since we've been in this period of high growth, the real per capita growth has only been about 1% or 1.1. In other words, we've almost lost half against trend, which is even greater than the one-third that most of the studies estimated. But there was one of the studies done by two European researchers, Dr. Carmen Cecerita and Dr. Philip Rother, was funded by the European Central Bank, published by the European Central Bank. And what they discovered is that as the debt levels move to these high areas where we are today, that the effect becomes nonlinear. And that is also consistent with the law of diminishing returns. The law of diminishing returns is a nonlinear relationship. This is hard for a lot of people to accept. They think that if you can just expand the debt levels by a large enough amount, that you'll get a better result. They don't understand that the mechanism is not there. And so you use the higher and higher debt levels and the results become worse.
I want to continue on that theme because you described the panic year in Japan in 1989, which was almost 29 years ago, almost 30 years ago. It seems to me that the over-indebtedness of Japan has been persistent since then. They never solved the problem. We've got now the United States has had its panic year in 2008. Since then, not only has the United States' indebtedness only increased, but China has come from way behind. It seems like they're almost in a contest to out-borrow and spend everybody else. China's credit expansion has been massive. What's the big picture globally here? It seems like there's a race on to get more and more over-indebted, almost like everybody's competing with everyone else. Where is this going to lead us eventually on a global scale?
In 2008, the over-indebtedness problem was in three areas of the world: the United States, Europe, and Japan. Today, the global economy is more indebted than 10 years ago because China was not indebted 10 years ago. It's massively increased, and so have the emerging economies. So initially, when the debt is used, it has a positive response. It's just it's overuse, excess use, that is the problem. But one of the things that I like to do is to look at the amount of GDP growth generated per each dollar of debt. And globally, in 2007, each dollar of debt generated 36 cents of GDP growth. Today, we're 20% lower, 31%. And 10 years ago, in China, a dollar of debt generated 61 cents of GDP growth. Today, it's only 33 cents. And Japan, each dollar of debt is only generating 22 cents. Now, the U.S. is doing a little bit better relative to the rest of the world. We're producing 40 cents of GDP growth for every dollar of debt, but that's down more than 10% from what it was in 2007. So the thing that's important to understand is that there are no major areas of the world that are lightly indebted, and we're all getting the same result. The debt can provide a transitory boost to economic activity. There's no question about that. But the effect wears off pretty quickly. And the European economy is slowing again. Japan actually contracted in the first quarter. The latest numbers out of China have been disappointing. And I think that this is the evidence that we see. The debt has this very brief interlude in which the economies respond, but ultimately the debt takes a slower. And I might just suggest, Eric, that you look up a paper written a long time ago, 1752, by the great David Hume. My professor, Ingrid Reima, said that the Enlightenment could not have happened without Hume. Hume was Adam Smith's mentor, very complete man. I think he knew everything there was to know about the world at the time of his life. In 1752, he wrote a paper called Of Public Finance. And Hume, who's probably one of our 10 greatest intellects, Smith said that he was the greatest mind that he ever met. And Smith knew everybody, including Voltaire and Ben Franklin. And Albert Einstein credited Hume's discussion of time and space as the inspiration for his theory of relativity. Hume was quite a thinker. And in this 1752 paper on Of Public Finance, he looked at two great civilizations that had become extremely over-indebted, the Mesopotamian and Roman, as well as a whole host of other cases. And his concluding remarks were something like this: when a government or a state has mortgaged all of its future revenues — it's a pretty scientific statement — when a government has mortgaged all of its future revenues, the state, by necessity, lapses into tranquility, languor, and impotence. Languor, of course, is an old-fashioned word from which we derive languishing. And I think that Hume's insight, working with not the sophisticated data that we have, or not the technological understandings that have occurred in the past 350 years since then give us insight that Hume actually understood it correctly. The over-indebtedness problem creates more additional problems. It will not solve an indebtedness problem. It makes it only worse.
So if this Japan, at least in the current era, was the first to really get to that extreme over-indebtedness, it's been 30 years, nothing has gotten markedly better there. The United States is massively over-indebted. China has, and as you say, emerging markets have joined the club. Everybody around the world, Eurozone, China, Japan, United States, is in this club of massive over-indebtedness. And as you've described, the law of diminishing returns means that even the interim benefit, the short-term benefit you get from going into more debt, is diminishing dramatically in terms of the GDP benefit per dollar of additional debt. You know, it sounds to me like the story of a systemic problem that it's in its late stages. How does this end? I mean, eventually, do you get to some kind of global reset where, you know, all of the debt is written off? What happens?
Well, there are people who call for a so-called debt jubilee. The problem is that you bankrupt your financial institutions because they hold so much of it, and there's really no way to write it off. That's the bottom line. There's no way to do a reset. You could go down the false road of changing the Federal Reserve Act, allowing the Federal Reserve to print money, but the only way money printing works is that if you increase the use of debt capital, which further triggers the law of diminishing returns, you will get a side effect of inflation, but you won't boost real growth. And so, in essence, you're just going to make people more miserable than they already are.
So in your opinion, is there a solution? If you were in charge of the whole world, grand dictator of everything, is there some policy choice that could be made that would solve this problem of a collapsing rate of real growth in the economies around the world? Or are we just too indebted and there's no way out?
We have to live within our means or have some event. You perhaps could have some sort of technological event. You might remember that we had a pretty miserable decade, slightly longer, after the debt bulge in the 1920s. And really, when World War II started, things were really not any better. When Germany invaded Poland, and that sort of began to help us a little bit because we were selling to all sides in the war, things improved a little bit. But even then, the unemployment rate was still 17%, not the extreme high levels in the worst days of the Depression, but the economy was doing rather poorly. And then World War II intervened. And, of course, World War II was a tragedy. Maybe 70 million people lost their lives. There was tremendous destruction, all kinds of human suffering in addition to the loss of life. But one of the consequences for the United States is that we had mandatory rationing. And sort of as an accident, unplanned accident, the saving rate in the United States went up to 28%. We had quite a few readings above 25%. And so what basically happened is we're able to pay down the debt of the 1920s. And so when World War II ended, a lot of economists, including Keynes himself before he died, as well as the American Keynes, Alvin Hansen, projected that we would go back into the Great Depression, but we did not. We had a very substantial recovery at the end of World War II, and we propelled the growth in the economy. We funded the Marshall Plan, rebuilt Europe and Japan, because we had cleaned up our balance sheet. It was kind of an accident. But to give you a more formal answer, what you want to read is the 2010 study done by McKinsey Global Research. You can go on their website and get the study. So basically, the thing that you have to do is you have to live within your means. You have to undergo a prolonged period of austerity, which, of course, people are not willing to stand for. That's what we did after the panic year of 1873. There was no central bank. There was no willingness to run budget deficits. We just We just lived within our means until we paid off the excessive debt of the 1860s and 1870s. It was a long, difficult time, but it solved the problem. We had another similar episode in the 1820s and 1830s. We took on a lot of debt to finance the early railroads, steamship lines. Then there was overinvestment, overconsumption. The panic year was 1838. Van Buren was president. He didn't know what hit him either. And we had a very, very difficult time period. And then a very fortuitous event occurred, sort of a technological, you could call it technological invention, but it wasn't. There was the discovery of gold in California. And this event caused a tremendous surge in economic activity. It financed the westward expansion. And the 1950s was the fastest decade of peacetime growth in U.S. history. Only wartime decades were faster. So you could have something of that equivalent, but the other thing is you have to have austerity. World War II was a period of austerity, serious austerity. If you wanted to buy 10 pounds of sugar, you couldn't do it. Maybe you had a ration book for five. If you wanted a new car, that was out of the question. If you wanted four new tires, that was out of the question. Maybe you could buy one. And so we had the income that was gained from selling all of our products to the rest of the world. We were selling to helping the other countries that were war zones. And so we had a tremendous benefit from our trade surpluses, and we became a very wealthy country. But the only controllable solution is to live inside one's means. And that's not something that any one of the popular democracies want to hear. And they think that there is a more immediate solution. And Japan has been trying that now unsuccessfully for 30 years. And we've been trying it unsuccessfully now since the 1990s. And the net result is that our trend rate of growth is almost half less than what it historically has been.
I'd like to come back to a subject of inflation. There are a lot of signs that we're seeing in the economic data that tell us maybe inflation and inflation expectations are starting to tick up. And also we've had kind of a flurry of economists saying they expect inflation to be on the horizon. Do you agree with those views? Is inflation sustainable in this economic environment of such slow money? You know, it's hard for me to understand inflation suddenly taking off when we have record low velocity of money. Is this sustainable? And if so, what does it do to your investment view?
Well, money supply growth in 2017 was in the fourth lowest quintile since 1900. But we're getting a further deceleration in money supply growth. And right now, the six-month rate of growth in money is under 3%. And the 1 year is under 4%. Historically, money has grown at about 6.75% since 1900. It's a very weak rate of growth. The velocity of money is actually in its fifth, the lowest quintile. Now, we do have increases in certain micro sectors of the economy. We've had a mini oil shock. OPEC producers have cut back on production, and the oil price has basically gone up 50% last year, more or less. And we're continuing to have increases in health insurance costs, and as a result of the natural disasters last year, there have been increases in property and casualty insurance. Now, these items that I just mentioned are what we call price inelastic goods and services. A price inelastic good is one that you do not have a good substitute for. If you go into the filling station and the price is up, you're more or less a price taker. You can make adjustments over time, you know, but they're not very good substitutes, and you can decide to walk and not pay it at all, but that option doesn't really readily exist. You may be able to move or something later on. With regard to medical and property and casualty insurance, you're basically a price taker. So when you get a confluence of increases in these price inelastic goods and money supply growth is decelerating, the consumers then have to cut back on what they're spending on discretionary goods. And so the price increases of inelastic goods basically therefore serve as a triggering mechanism for a downturn in the rest of the economy. It's kind of a supply-side shock of some sort. And it's ultimately not inflationary. It will increases in price in inelastic products will boost the inflation rate over the short run, but ultimately inflation is what I would define as a money price wage spiral. You have to have a monetary acceleration that raises prices, and then wages will follow. Inflation is not a wage price spiral. And similarly, if firms decide they want to pay workers more and money supply growth is decelerating, then it will erode profit margins. And so what we've actually seen is that if you go back to 2014, the unemployment rate was close to 6%, and real average hourly earnings, which is for the non-supervisory workers, at that point in time, it was growing about 3% per annum. Well, the unemployment rate now is under 4%, but in the 12 months ending April, real average hourly earnings are unchanged. So it doesn't mean that you cannot have transitory bouts in inflation, but when money supply and the velocity of money are acting in such a pattern as they are today, the price increases serve to weaken the economy and undermine future growth.
Well, Dr. Hunt, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Before we close, please tell our institutional listeners where they can find out more about what you do at Hoisington Investment Management.
Well, they can go on our website, hoisingtonmgd.com. We publish a quarterly letter, which we put on our website, and we make that letter available on the website as a public service to institutional clients. And so if they're interested in following how we at Hoisington think about the future, you can read our quarterly review. It comes out within 10 or 12 days after the end of a calendar quarter.
And I'll add that it is extremely well-respected in the industry as one of the most insightful pieces of reading on fixed income markets. Dr. Hunt, thank you so much. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Dr. Lacey Hunt. I want to get to your comments on it in a moment, but first I wanted to welcome the macro tourist from East West Management himself, Kevin Muir. Welcome to the show, Kevin.
Great to be with you guys again.
Thanks. Now, Eric, I wanted to get your impression on that interview with Dr. Lacey Hunt. Now, Eric, I'm a big fan of Dr. Lacey Hunt, and though his bigger picture secular outlook has not changed much over the years, I felt it was actually important to bring him back on the show, largely because the bond bears have been dominating the headlines, and I really wanted to bring some balance back, give some pushback on some of the other sides of the argument. You know, I was particularly waiting throughout the interview for him to comment on the surge on oil prices and the subsequent influence on inflation. Where I really feel I agree with him is this idea that while higher oil gives a temporary, you know, flow through to higher prints in inflation, it will ultimately lead to a drag on the economy that will drag growth down in the longer term. What was your takeaway from the interview?
Well, Patrick, what really struck me the most was the comments that he made about the debt trap that the whole world is getting to. You know, you look at the situation that has endured in Japan for the last 30 years. And yeah, it's not Holocaust, it's not the end of the world, but they've had a really crappy time. You know, they called it the lost decade at first, and then another decade went by, and then another decade went by. And they've never fully recovered from that event. And what Dr. Hunt is telling us is the rest rest of the world has joined the party. Now we've got the Eurozone and China and the United States in the same pickle of just radical over-indebtedness. And as he described, once you get so far indebted that there's basically no way out, and that happened at the end of the 1920s, it wasn't the Great Depression that solved it. It was World War II that solved it. Well, we can't solve it with World War III this time, because now that we have nuclear weapons, World War III would end humanity. So we're not going to do that. So what is going to get us out of this, or is the whole world headed for 30 years of economic stagnation? Is stagflation going to become a secular theme for the next 30 years worldwide? And oh my goodness, what would the social implications of that be? And, you know, it doesn't really help us in terms of deciding how to invest in fixed income in the next 6 months. But to me, in terms of the big picture of the world, what he had to say about the debt trap that the whole world is in was really striking to me. Kevin, what's your take, not just on Dr. Hunt's comments, but generally? I mean, we've gotten to the point where there's just this massive over-indebtedness, both public and private. And, you know, we're not going to get out of it by solving it through World War III. That's not the right answer. What happens next?
Eric, I completely agree. The debt problem is huge, and it's just getting worse. But what I think is funny is when people assume that the debt problem will somehow be solved by deflation. You know, in 2008, we had kind of our first taste of deflation, and governments decided that they wanted nothing about it. So basically, what they ended up doing was printing and printing and printing. So what I have a trouble with is when people assume that because we have a lot of debt, that this will somehow eventually make deflation, I argue that the opposite will happen. Eventually, this debt will have to be inflated away. And that basically will mean lower and lower rates until the bond market revolts and we get the steep yield curve because we've tried to inflate our way out of it too many times.
Well, that's an interesting outlook. Now, Kevin, I brought you back on the show, though, because I actually wanted to talk to you about some of the interesting articles you wrote over the last few weeks. And I felt you could give our listeners some more context on. Now, the first one I wanted to actually touch upon was your article titled Pink Tickets on Quantitative Tightening Days. Now, you pointed out an interesting pattern when there were large amounts of treasury bonds rolling off the Fed's balance sheet. Why don't you take us through your thoughts on this?
Sure. Patrick, were you trading S&Ps back in 2010?
I was.
And do you remember the times when all of a sudden you would get up in the morning and it would seem like the stock market was getting weak and it felt like it would just take a little bit of selling and it would take off onto the downside and it wouldn't take much to start the ball rolling to the negative?
Yes.
Do you remember those days? And then what would happen is all of a sudden out of nowhere, there would get a bid and it would happen at 10:30, 11 o'clock. And it really wasn't explainable. Like you looked at the charts, there was no level in the chart that all of a sudden kind of indicated that there should be buying. There was nothing in terms of the news. There was no particular stock that was doing well. Well, I remember this and I remember being confused by it. And I remember thinking to myself, what's going on? Where is this bid coming from? And it took me a little while, but eventually after some sleuthing, I figured out these days often happened on the QE days, meaning that the days that the Federal Reserve was coming in and buying bonds. So that was the quantitative easing days. And eventually what I started to do was I started to track it because the Federal Reserve would publish their schedule in advance. So you would know it was coming. And then you could actually look at the performance of the days when the Fed was buying bonds and then the days that the Fed wasn't buying bonds. And when you looked at it, it was statistically very significant. You know, I can't explain why. I don't have a real good reason for why those days should be better because them buying bonds shouldn't be that quick. It shouldn't go into the stock market that quick, but yet it did. And so I basically have learned to not question it and just realize that these quantitative easing days are days when the stock market outperformed. And so I started to think about the quantitative tightening days that we're basically faced with now. So the quantitative tightening is the exact opposite of quantitative easing. But the only difference is that the Federal Reserve, instead of selling down their balance sheet by selling bonds, they're actually just letting them come off as they mature. But the problem with this is that they're actually kind of lumpy. So you get days when they have, instead of back in the quantitative easing days, they had $6 billion purchases. Well, on the quantitative tightening days, they have $25 billion redemption days. So that means that the quantitative tightening is actually much stronger and bigger than the quantitative easing days.
And I found this out for the fellow by Martingale Macro posted the performance of the S&P on the quantitative tightening days. And you'll see that they were dramatically underperformed. On May 15th, it was down 70 basis points. On April 30th, it was down 80 basis points. On March 31st, it was down 220 basis points. February 28th, it was down 100 basis points. These are days when we had large redemptions of the Fed's balance sheet. And you saw that it was very clear that the S&P underperformed on those days.
So I have to ask you, you were showing that May 31st, there's $29 billion maturing. What should we be watching for?
Well, if the same thing happens, we should expect the S&P to be down. Now, it gets a little bit more tricky here, though, because although the Fed has redemptions and there is a schedule for redemptions, they also have a schedule for how much they're going to allow run off the balance sheet each and every month. And if we look at it, they're actually only due to have $8 billion more run off the balance sheet. So although we're going to have another large redemption of $25 billion, that more than likely means that they're going to have $17 that they're going to reinvest through what would have been called previously quantitative easing by buying bonds. But in this case, it will be the balance sheet going back into the market, basically getting reinvested. So it won't be as big as the previous one, because the previous one was $25 billion. This is only going to be an $8 billion. But then the next month, we're going to, at the end of June, we're going to have another $25 billion. So the important thing to realize is that you should be watching the schedule of redemptions for the Fed's balance sheets and assuming that those days, the market most likely will struggle.
Now, Kev, I want to move on to your next piece. You had a piece, Break-Evens, Tips, and the Harsh Realities. And in it, you did a comparison of the TLT, which those not familiar with it is the 20-year Treasury bond ETF, and the TIPS, which are the inflation-protected notes. And so you point out the negative return on the TIPS year to date. Why don't you take a moment to explain what you were trying to illustrate in the article?
Sure. Well, I've been a big bond bear for quite some time. And I've been advocating owning TIPS as an alternative to owning bonds, because I think that in an inflationary or rising inflationary environment, that TIPS are going to outperform. But one of the things that you need to realize about TIPS is that TIPS still have a real yield component, meaning that when you go buy a TIP, you receive a yield plus an inflation adjustment. And that adjustment is based upon the CPI. So when a couple of years ago, 10-year TIPS were basically yielding zero, meaning that you had the real yield was only like was zero. So you would earn only the CPI return going forward. Well, what's happened during this latest bond bear market is that although inflation has risen, which has caused bonds to decline, at the same time, real yields have also risen, meaning that that TIP that used to yield zero plus the inflation is now yielding almost 100 basis points plus the inflation. So when you have a 10-year TIP that has gone from zero to 1%, that creates a loss of principal, just like if you owned a bond that went from 2% to 3%. So what I was trying to show was that if you are bullish on inflation, merely owning TIPS is not good enough. And I talked about another product that is the RINF, which is an ETF which follows the 30-year break-even swap spreads, is a much better product to own. This product owns TIPS, but instead of just owning TIPS outright, it's actually short treasuries on the other side. So that when you get an increase in yields, and then you also get an increase in real yields, it protects you against that because it is giving you only the inflationary break-even level. So whereas the TIPS were actually down year to date 2%, the RINF was actually up 6% this year. So that was an outperformance of 800 basis points. And so for the real inflation bull out there, owning an RINF product is actually what you need to own instead of just TIPS outright.
Kevin, I want to get your take on what's going on with yields and where they're headed, because as I mentioned earlier in our market wrap, you know, for a while, Jeff Gundlach and all these other visionaries were saying, okay, look, 3.05, red line in the sand. If we break through it, it's a one-way trip. We're not coming back. Once we get that breakout, it's going to be, you know, we'll be at 3.5 before you know it. Well, guess what? That didn't happen. We had a very dramatic breakout last week past 3.05, came back, was 3.06 when we taped last week's show, looked like maybe it was going to be that very conventional, you know, come back and retest resistance, it becomes support, and you keep going. Well, that didn't happen. By Wednesday afternoon this week, we were back below 3% on the 10-year yield. So it makes me wonder, was this all just a big head fake? Is that short squeeze that a lot of us feared maybe still on the table? What's going on here? What do you make of this? And maybe that's a good segue for us to talk about a piece that you wrote about how, you know, it's cool to be bearish in the bond market. It seems to be the way to look like a cool kid these days. But what's really going on, and what's the bigger picture?
I completely agree with you, Eric. It's gone from the bears were the uncool kids a couple of years ago. The three Ds of debt, deflation, and demographics were going to cause rates and inflation to stay down forever, to now the point where everyone is bearish and everyone thinks that rates are headed only one way, except for the permables, as I like to call them, the ones who think inflation and interest rates are headed to zero. But those are the only guys standing in terms of on the bond market sentiment. So I looked at it and said to myself, well, the bond market is giving us some signals, some clues. You look at the yield curve is flattening. We're now 8 or 9 years into this economic expansion, and we're getting running late in terms of how long these last. And I'm getting nervous in terms of the potential for this bond bear market to continue. And I look at it and say to myself, although I agree that I'm at heart a secular bear, believing that we're going to get more inflation over the long run and that rates are headed higher, I wondered how there was very few cyclical bulls anymore. There was very few people that were calling for the next move to be just kind of a rally within a bear market. And that's in essence what I wanted to write about and talk about, was that, you know, secular bear markets don't go one way forever. You get moves, cyclical moves within there. And to me, it's looking like it might be a period where we get the bond market rallying and surprising everybody.
Kevin, I want to ask you a question about positioning, because, you know, I trade commodities like crude oil, and it's really easy to look at the commitment of traders reports and you can tell how many people are all on one side of the boat. It's a more complicated picture with treasuries, because treasury futures are where a lot of speculators are speculating, but really it's the treasuries themselves that are the much bigger, deeper market. So when we see something like record short interest, everybody on one side of the boat levered up short on treasury futures. You know, if we were talking copper futures, where the whole market is in the futures, I'd say, okay, everybody's on one side of the boat, you want to be on the other side. What do you think about an indication like that in the treasury market, where the underlying treasuries are a much bigger market than the futures market?
Well, you're absolutely right, Eric. And it's much more complicated, because don't forget, there's also portfolio managers with duration benchmarks. And there's all sorts of ways that you can basically bet against treasuries. You can go and you can have, instead of, if your mandate is to have a 7-year duration, you can go down to a 4 or 3-year duration. And in essence, that ends up being a short position. So although it is more difficult to look at just one indicator like the COT, the commitment of traders, and say, this is for sure going to be a reflection of sentiment, there's still other ways you can get a sense of where everybody is. And one of the things that I like to do is I like to just go and read everybody's opinion about in terms of where they think treasuries are headed. And apart from those permabulls who have stayed steadfast in the face of this bond bear market, I'm hard pressed to find people that are calling for the short squeeze that you and I are probably looking for. It seems to me when I pull up my Twitter and go through it, it's everybody's selling rallies, everybody's getting short, everybody thinks that rates are only going one way and inflation's only going one way. And it seems to be that the only guys that are left calling for maybe a bond bull market are the guys that think rates are going to zero. So I'm kind of in between. I don't think that rates are going to zero, but I definitely think that the potential for short squeeze has never been higher in terms of the bond market.
So Kev, to wrap things up, I wanted to just get your take. Yesterday, there was the Fed minutes that came out. The headline was, the hike is coming, but they will allow a dovish inflation overshoot. We saw the S&P 500 more or less almost immediately reverse higher yesterday. And at the same time, bonds also rallied on that news. What's your take or first impression of what happened on that Fed minute?
Well, for the bond bears, I actually think that that development is much more scary than a Federal Reserve that's trying to get out ahead of inflation. At the end of the day, what a long-term bond investor should fear is inflation. So if for a Federal Reserve to come out and say that they're willing to tolerate higher inflation should actually be their worst nightmare. And if you look at the curve, you'll notice that the 530s did steepen, meaning that the difference between the 5-year and the 30-year rate steepened. That would be expected in that sort of environment. And ultimately, I think that's why we're going to get the biggest bond bear market that we've ever seen, because eventually what's going to happen is that the Federal Reserve is going to allow more and more inflation. And they're going to be stuck at this kind of paradoxical problem where they can't raise rates because there's too much debt out there, yet they can't not raise rates because inflation's taking off. And that will create a vicious self-defeating circle that actually causes the bond market to basically take away the keys from the Federal Reserve. And that's ultimately kind of my nightmare scenario, where I see the long end going no bid and the Fed desperately trying to keep the short end in check so that people don't get hammered from higher rates.
Well, Kevin, I really want to thank you for coming and joining us in this week's postgame segment. Before we let you go, please tell our listeners where they can follow your work.
Well, you can catch me on Twitter at Kevin Muir, M-U-I-R, or you can follow my blog at themacrotourist.com. Thanks a lot, guys.
Okay, Kevin, thanks again for your help. We really appreciate it. And listeners, we need your help as well. Please forward your research roundup emails, tell your friends and colleagues about Macro Voices, help us promote the show, because the more registered users we have at macrovoices.com, the more able Patrick is to negotiate to get the very best feature interview guests. So please go to macrovoices.com if you haven't already. Register your free account. It only takes a few minutes, doesn't cost anything. We won't spam you or try to sell you anything. And the benefit to you is that you'll receive our free research roundup email each week, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all of the coolest downloads that we could find on the internet, including presentations from our feature interview guests. Now, as our regular listeners know, normally we have all of the links in our research roundup. Last week and this week, we have a little bit of an exception with our webmaster on holiday. You'll have to log in to the website and go to the research library in order to find all those links. Patrick, tell them what they can find this week in the research library. And of course, next week, we'll be back to our regular system where everything is in the research roundup email.
All right. Well, this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Dr. Lacey Hunt. You'll also find the Hoisington Investment Management first quarter of 2018 quarterly review, where you'll find all of the insights from Lacey in writing. You will also find the links to Kevin Muir's Macro Tourist blog articles that we referenced in the post game, and many, many more interesting articles that we're posting up there. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already.
You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.